Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, America. I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education and an avid, lifelong hunter, and you're listening to The Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. And I'm very excited because my very special guest today, Mr. David Peterson, has been a hunter since he was 8 years old. He's a passionate traditionalist. He's a bow hunter. He has degrees. He has a BS in psychology and sociology and a BA in writing with honors. More importantly to me, he has been a Marine Corps aviator. Thank you for your service, Mr. Peterson. A magazine editor, an adjunct college professor, former Colorado field director for Trout Unlimited's public lands conservation programs. And to sum it up, because I could go on and on and on about awards, what this man has contributed to the sport of hunting in this country. But to sum it up, he is a man who could express through the verbal or written word the hunter's complete experience, and absolutely more vividly and truthful than I would ever hope to be able to do. So, Mr. Peterson, thank you for giving up a morning of elk hunting and joining us here today on the Wild Game Domain.
Hi, Chad. Hi, New York. Glad to be here.
Thank you very much. I know it seems a little unreal, right? I'm sitting here in Brooklyn, New York, Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we're about to do a half-hour show about hunting and the great outdoors. That's how I feel every Monday morning when I get on the station here. So could you talk to us a little bit? I mean, we're going to get into the numerous books. One of those books, which really changed the way I look at the great outdoors and hunting in general. But can we talk a little bit about you growing up in the Great Plains, a little bit about your upbringing, and then, you know, how you got into hunting at such a young age?
Well, I was born in 46, so I'm 68 now. So things were a little different back then. And I grew up in Oklahoma City, but on the southern edge, where it was the term suburbs hadn't been invented then, but that's what it was. So I was could get on my bicycle, and in 10 or 15 minutes, I could be out to where there was an awful lot of abandoned farmland around then, from the Depression, old farmhouses falling down, stock ponds. He's gone back feral, and it was full of fish and full of quail and wow. Squirrels and rabbits. And so those are the things I started hunting. And my high school actually had a rifle team, if you can believe that.
No, I can't believe that.
The world has changed.
Yeah.
I was really lucky with the Boy Scouts, because at that time, you know, all the leaders, our fathers, were either Korean or World War II vets, and most of them had grown up on a farm, so they knew how to do this stuff, you know, how to trap rabbits and to what one tree was and what another one was. And so I was rotten in town. When I was in town, I was in trouble. And I found out, and my parents found out really early, that if I was out in the woods or at the lake or something, I was going to be fine. So they really encouraged that, and that's how it got going.
So that's great. So you found this love of the outdoors, and obviously, eventually, you know, it's funny you bring up, you know, getting in trouble in town. And that sounds like a Marine Corps officer to me, or anybody in the Marine Corps. So you decided to serve your nation. Does that come from the heart? Did that come because you got in trouble? You punched someone out at a bar? How did that come about?
I'm not sure. I think it came about because I was young and bored and skinny. And about half of my high school graduating class, those who weren't able to go to college, were drafted, and most of them didn't come back. And there was just this whole complex of things that made me decide to do that. I would not have been drafted because I was going to school. But I don't know. Looking, you know, it's what young men do.
Now, so you actually, though, you know, it sounds very similar to my story, but you became an officer in the Marine Corps, which is no easy task. So you obviously took to the lifestyle and the service to your nation and became a Marine aviator. You flew helicopters. Can you talk a little bit about that experience? Were you just kind of, did you kind of fall into it, or?
Well, I don't know. This is, you're hitting on one of the things that I'm still wonder about and understand, at least in my own life.
But well, good.
I enlisted, and I went through, I had 1 year of college, and I went through all of the enlisted training in San Diego. I went to the rifle range, and they're going to draft me into sniper school because I was one of the top shooters. And so that's what I was looking at, was going home on leave after all that training and coming back and being sent to Okinawa for sniper school. And it wasn't the program it is now, very competitive program now. But back then, it wasn't.
Right.
And what year was it? I don't mean to interrupt you. They had a program called Enlisted Commissioning Program, and I applied for it if you had 1 year of college, and I went through all these tests and stuff, and miraculously I got selected. So instead of going to Vietnam, I wound up in Quantico, Virginia at officer school, which was a piece of cake compared to enlisted training. And after that, I qualified for flight school and went to flight school. So basically, I spent the first 2-3 years of my tour of duty going to school. And I went in as a private, came out as a captain. I don't know that I could do that today.
Well, thank you for your service. And our parallels. While I was an enlisted man, the same thing. I grew up, you know, in the outdoors, hunting and shooting, and I decided to drop out of college, join the Army, and you know, they pegged me as someone who knew how to handle a firearm, and ended up in Army sniper school, and the rest is history. And the way I phrase it for me is, I wouldn't go back for all the money in the world, but I wouldn't give up those memories for all the money in the world either. Well, thank you for your service, and I appreciate you talking about that. This show, we try to focus on that a little bit in the country, and soldiers, no matter what generation they come from. You mentioned the Korean War, World War II. You know, the greatest generation, those guys. And that's what I kind of aspire to be. And I want my son to kind of not necessarily be a soldier, but, you know, service to his nation. And I appreciate that. And having said that, let's get into some hunting now, because I have a problem I need help with, David. I'm a lifelong sustainable hunter. I hunt for food. I hunt for the meat. And I'm having a problem. As a psychologist, maybe you could help me with this. When I shoot or harvest a squirrel, I have absolutely no emotional response to it. When I shoot a turkey, there is no emotional response, and I'm starting to feel like maybe I have a problem. But when I take down a whitetail at 20 yards from my tree stand, where I was just staring it in the eye, there is an amazing amount of emotion that pours out of me. Now, I'm a man. I refuse to cry. But if I would let it go after that deer went down, I probably could cry. No one's ever been able to explain why I have an emotional response to bigger animals and not smaller animals, when I know I'm taking the life of an animal.
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. You know, the closer an animal is to us, the more empathy we're going to feel for it. So I probably started that way, but at this point, you know, I feel uncomfortable knocking a fish on the head. So I think it's the idea of once you've got it in your hand, it doesn't have any choice. But deer is a mammal. It's much bigger. I have one friend who is what he calls the big brown eye syndrome. He had to give up bow hunting because he couldn't shoot animals at that range at 20 yards. He has no problem at 200 yards. So, you know, it's like, I don't know, hand-to-hand combat or dropping a bomb.
Or being a sniper, for that matter.
In that regard. But it's total. I think it's almost anyone you talk to would say, yeah, I have more trouble killing a deer or an elk than I do a squirrel or a fish or a rabbit. They just somehow subconsciously remind us of ourselves, the eyes in particular. It bothers me, you know, for instance, that elk die with their eyes open and you can't even make them go close. So right. You're looking that animal in the eye, you know. So the way I deal with it is I think about this stuff a lot until it comes the time to kill, and then I'm lucky I just have a switch I flip, and all I think about is getting the job done efficiently and humanely. Once the animal is dead, I don't make a big production out of it. I just say thank you to it and immediately go to work taking it apart, because as meat, it doesn't bother you.
Right.
The animal's lying there and you're staring at it, you think about all these things, but just get to work, and it's not a problem.
Right. Now
that's the way I deal with it.
Now, you're speaking to me, and you just said that, it was so well said. As a traditionalist, you're a traditionalist, you're a bow hunter. So, has there ever been a situation where you were out hunting over the years where you took a bad shot and had to deal with that? I know, most bow hunters, that's happened to us at some point in our hunting careers. Have you ever made that mistake? Maybe you switched the switch didn't work one day, and you took a bad shot on an elk and lost it, or had to see it suffer.
I believe that anyone who hunts extensively, who has hunted a long time, has made those mistakes, and if they claim they haven't, I've got my doubting hat on.
Right.
It happens. If you hunt long enough, and even those of us who absolutely go out of our way, who willingly pass up marginal shots, it's still going to happen to you once in a while, so you have to be prepared for it. And all you can do is redouble your efforts to recover that animal, and failing that, really seriously talk to yourself about what you did wrong, work on it, and try not to let it happen again. I certainly have had that happen. And in fact, I'm known as a critic of hunting, or a critic of certain aspects of hunting, the culture of hunting as it's become today, we could say. And that grew out of my own mistakes. I've lost several animals, and I've been hunting elk since 1981, pretty much every year, and I kill one pretty much every year, generally with a longbow. And I lost a few in the early years, and surprisingly, it wasn't because I was taking overly long shots or marginal shots or not placing my arrow. It was because I couldn't get any penetration and using the standard equipment. And that set me on the path of researching that. And now I'm a real big disciple of heavy arrows. And I know you shoot a compound, and what someone uses is their own business, but that's my only real concern with the compound community these days, is, and the media and the industry is driving it, but everyone wants to take long shots. For that, you need fast arrows, flat trajectory. For that, you need light arrows. So you might do just fine on deer with that, but there are an awful lot of elk being wounded needlessly with well-placed arrows because they don't have enough momentum to take them on through. So that's more than you ask, but that's kind of how it all evolved in my mind. I made mistakes. I tried to figure out why and correct those mistakes, and then I started trying to share that information with others so they didn't have to go through what I did.
No, that's an excellent answer, and I appreciate that you mentioned you're a critic, and I was kind of saving this discussion for the end of the interview, but since you brought it up, being kind of a critic of hunting in general, your writing is out there for everyone, and I've read one of your books that I want to talk about a little bit later, but you're found throughout the internet, different articles, different magazines, and I don't know exactly what article it was, but you were writing about your position on canned or caged hunts, and I actually have the same position. You're not a fan of them, and you make the point very well. But you seem to tie in the practice of farm-raised wild game into this canned hunt idea, the idea that we could raise animals behind a cage and these people could sell hunts, and then you seem to tie in farm raised. You're not a big fan of farm raised wild game, and I was wondering if you could expand upon that a little bit.
Well, I'm a little bit confused on the distinction. The alternative term for canned shooting, I don't want to call it hunting, is elk farming, for instance. They're synonymous, at least out here in the West, because that's where you get your animals to put in the fence for people to shoot.
Right.
You raise them. So are you talking about birds or some other aspect of...
No, mammals, elk and deer, you know, venison in general. I thought I had read something that you weren't a big fan of farm-raised wild game for consumption. I mean, to sell.
Oh, okay. All right, here's quickly the rundown on that, and it may well be pretty much the same with whitetail in the East, but elk is the big thing out here. And so you have elk farms, elk ranches, and they raise all these tame elk in just like cattle in fenced enclosures. And their markets, first of all, they saw the velvet antlers off the bulls every year to sell to the Orient as an aphrodisiac. I had thought Viagra might wipe that out, but I guess the tradition is pretty strong over there. So they sell meat to restaurants, and the bigger bulls, after they've lived their active antler production cycle, and they're getting 8, 7, 8, 10 years old, and the antlers they start atrophying, and they're not as valuable as before, but they're still big. Then they'll mark these animals as what they call shooter bulls, and very few farm operations shoot the animals there. They're too close to towns and stuff. So what they do is put them in a horse trailer, ship them off to another part of the state or even another state where they do have a shooting operation, turn them out in the pasture, and in a day or two somebody comes in and shoots them down. So they're absolutely, you know, they're the same thing, farming and canned shooting.
Okay.
So, no, I'm not against any of it. I mean, I am against all of it, excuse me. Aside from the ethics and morality and lack of dignity in going in and shooting an animal that has no chance of escape. There's all kinds of biological problems. There's a huge risk. That's the primary way that chronic wasting disease, bovine tuberculosis, other diseases are created and spread. They're created through these concentrated farmyard situations that they raise these animals in. Mm-hmm. Then those animals sometimes escape. The fences go down. They can even pass it along. Say there's two elk, one's wild and one's inside a fence, and they come up to the fence at night and touch noses. They can spread it that way.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. It's very funny you bring up that scenario, because my whole show last week was on chronic wasting disease and the spread of it here. We're starting to see, you know, I would say the early stages of it here in New York State. Now in Western New York, there's been a few cases of it. So it was a concern, and I did it. I covered it on the show last week. And that's one of my concerns with farm-raised wild game as it is. And so, you know, thank you for clarifying that for me. We are actually 17 minutes into the show right now, and if it's okay with my very special guest, David Peterson, today, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back with the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. I am joined today by my special guest, Mr. David Peterson, elk hunter and author extraordinaire. Which brings up the one book, and I'm embarrassed to say, but I'm an honest man, so and I mean to get to the rest of your books, which I believe there are 12 of them that could be found at davidpetersonbooks.com, and I recommend them to anybody. But I read A Hunter's Heart, Honest Essay on Blood, And I felt a connection. And you know, I feel a connection. You know, maybe there's this thought that all hunters are connected in some way. And I guess maybe being from the Northeast, I don't always have that feeling. And maybe I'm a bow hunter, primarily a bow hunter, and then I try to avoid the rifle. And I moved to muzzle loading late in the season here. And I hate to admit this, but I feel superior to a lot of hunters in my approach and in how I respect the game. And when I read your book, it kind of gave me hope that there are plenty of other people out there who think of it just like me. You know, the joy and sadness that kind of happen in that moment when you're taking an animal, it really struck home for me. What was kind of the inspiration for that book or any of your books? I mean, you've written 12, I believe 12 books, correct me if I'm wrong. What's the inspiration for these books? Is it money? Is it the love of the sport? Are you a brilliant man? We need to have your words in print. Can you sum it up for me?
Well, I think there's too much there to sum up, but I'll try to be as terse as I can. But it's a complicated subject. Again, something that I've thought about a lot. As far as I guess what you're asking there at the end, the point question is why do I write about nature and hunting, or why do I write at all? And I don't know. I never set out to do that. I just kind of fell into it after I got out of the Marines and as a magazine editor, and then I started writing, and I just found out, well, here's something I can do without having to commute in traffic, without having to listen to somebody else's junk music on the radio at the office all day because they outrank me, something that I can change as my interest changes, and something that is guaranteed to keep me broke the rest of my life. So I was really fortunate. I don't have any children, and I was really fortunate to meet a lady in who shared my values. All we did was go. We were living in Southern California at the time, and we just would go camping and backpacking and fly fishing constantly. And so we decided to jump ship and move to the Rockies and built a little cabin and make a life here. So mostly I don't write about living in the mountains and hunting. I mean, I don't do those things in order to have something to write about. It's the other way around. I write because it facilitates me living in the mountains, working at home, having an awful lot of free time. For instance, I can generally arrange to pretty much take the whole month of September off to hunt. Try that with any other job. So we just kind of went into a simple, non-material life. You know, I haven't bought a new car in 40 years. It's the kind of thing that's not important to me. It's having free time and living in a place where I can walk out the door and be in the woods. So it's just a matter of priorities. And so far as how the writing about ethical aspects of hunting, which is what you were suggesting, that kind of all evolved back when Bugle Magazine, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, was the best hunting publication going. And they just encouraged people to write about conservation, to write about ethics, and I was one of those people, and I started looking around and said, there's really a lot of really good thoughts here with hunters being critical of certain aspects of hunting. And that's the way you defend something you love, is you admit what's wrong with it and you go to bat and try to fix it. And so that's kind of what I did with that first book, which I did not write, by the way. I wrote one essay, and I just collected the essays and edited them in that book, A Hunter's Heart, Honest Essays on Blood Sport. There's 41 contributors, and it was the first book that had ever been published that had contemporary writers, people that are living and hunting and writing today, talking about why they loved hunting and what it is that breaks their heart about what's happening today. And to sum that up very briefly, it's pretty clear to me that the hunting is a subculture, and I call the main culture, American culture, the mother culture. And if you look at what's wrong with hunting today, you can trace that back with what's wrong with the mother culture today. If you look at what's right with hunting, that's in the culture too. So hunting is instinctive. That's how we wouldn't be human if we hadn't become become hunters would still be in trees eating oranges. And so that part of it, that couldn't be any more natural. What culture has done to it and twisted it around, and that's the problem. So that's the distinction I try to make in my writing, is that, you know, not all hunting is the same. Not all hunters are the same. We can make this choice to be slobs and not have respect for the animals, or we can make a choice to do it right with dignity and honor our ancestry as hunters.
Right. That's a great answer. And it brings up, in a lot of your writings, I've noticed too, the idea of human evolution and hunting, the idea we were hunters and gatherers, and how that kind of flows through our bodies to this day. But, you know, my question would be, I mean, obviously, as a hunter, and it's funny you mentioned, you put yourself in a position so you could take the hunting season and get out there and enjoy that, and you need that. And I've done the same thing in my life. I'm a chef instructor at a culinary school, so I can take September, October, November, and December. I don't work. Or very periodically. Yeah, I'm a very lucky man. But, you know, it came from my love and need of the outdoors, and having to, I needed that in my life to kind of exist, and I chalk it up, as a dumb guy from Brooklyn, as human evolution. I am not denying my evolution. I need to be in the woods stalking wild prey. Why, if it is part of our evolution, hunting, why don't more people? I think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, only 5% of the general population in this country actually go out and hunt. How can that number be so low if it is in our evolution and it's the natural thing we are supposed to do?
A couple of things there. The statistics I've got are different than that, and but it's in the teens, and I think it varies from the low teens to the high teens, the percentage of people who report having hunted in the past year. There are people who, you know, maybe go out and bird hunt a time or two before football season kicks in, and then people like you and I who hunt every chance we get. So you could, you know, break those statistics down, but it's certainly a significant minority, let's call it that, right, who hunt. The word is sublimation. That is, other things kind of override this. We were hunters and gatherers no matter where we lived, what we hunted, and that includes fishing. Everybody who ever lived on this planet until about 10 or 12,000 years ago, when we gradually started domesticating animals and growing crops. So we've only had that very short amount of time, and that's not enough time genetically to change our instincts. So there's still, trying to think of the biological term for it, an inclination to do that. It's not an instinct insofar as, well, you just have to do that, but the inclination is there. But if your whole life is in a city, you don't know anyone who hunts, you don't know anything about it, it's not that strong that it's just going to come out. Obviously, it's stronger in some of us. I was just like you. I lived in a good place to grow up hunting and fishing, but I didn't. My dad didn't hunt. All he did was work. So it came out of me. I mean, it was in there automatically. But more people don't do it because, for one, it's getting harder to do. It was easy when I was young, but now, you know, you live in a city, not just in the East, but anywhere. You're going to have to do some driving. You're going to have to find, as a kid, you're going to have to find a mentor, right, to take you hunting and fishing. And those people are getting hard to come by. So we do what's put in front of our faces. And culture pretty much tells us what to do. And it says, you know, you want to do the dancing and the music thing. You want to get a good education, a good job, drive a nice car. You do all those things, have the kids, and that's kind of spelled out for us. And it takes some spine or maybe some insanity to go against that. But it's in there. It's just not in there in a major way, and it is more so in some people like you and I.
That's so well said. We are actually running out of time here, and I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about your project, The Good Hunt, a little bit here. I'm a little confused by it and where you are. I was hoping you could update me. Documentary about yourself.
I'm a little confused by it, too. a fellow from a filmmaker from Europe, from Brussels, Belgium, of all places, contacted me about 4 years ago and wanted to come do a documentary film on my lifestyle and on my thoughts about hunting. And it took him 2 years to talk me into it. But I finally agreed to it. He came out and spent a hunting season with me year before last, and went hunting with me every day for a better part of a month. And we shot this documentary film, and that's all it set out to be, was an antidote to the crap you see on TV. You know, guys shooting behind fences, and it's just all staged and caged and set up, and there's no sport to it. And let's show people what an honest hunt is. So there was nothing more to it than him following me around for a month. But then it turned into something bigger than that when he got home with the footage and kind of a lifestyle film. There was some interest there in how my wife and I have chosen to live differently than most people. So the dominant theme is ethical hunting, and this sub-theme of kind of a Mother Earth News, Thoreauvian lifestyle thing. Well, it's been in production 2 years, and when we hang up, I'll be working on it with the guy, and with any luck, it will start going out to film festivals this fall.
Oh, excellent. Okay, and we could keep track of that at www.thegoodhunt.net, is that right?
That's correct.
And I would also like to promote for you davidpetersonbooks.com. I recommend this man's books, and I'm recommending them to myself now. Thank you. Thank you so much. I know you gave up a lot this morning to be with us, and I really appreciate it. And I thank you for your time. And I'm sorry to put this off, but I'm sorry to hear about your wife. She sounds like a wonderful lady. And just really thank you for joining us today, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Chad. And thanks for tracking me down. And thanks for doing this good program. People need to hear alternative views like this.
Yeah, especially right here in this cesspool of New York City.
You're doing your part to make it better.
I'm trying, and certainly you're leading the way. So thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Chad.
All right. That was a great interview. But that's all the time we have today. Thank you very much to my producer, Jack. Thank you. Remember, davidpetersonbooks.com. Thank you for listening to the heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.